This is The Curious Gamer, a show about the culture, design, and joy of games. I'm Devin Pulaski. I'm going to be perfectly honest. You're about to hear how a fictional video game hedgehog character has improved my life in various ways. And it's a story spread over 2 episodes. Yeah, I know. For many of you, that's a definitive yikes. But before you go, or hopefully stay, let me share why I think stories like these matter. See, mine is a happy tale, but a lot of people don't get to experience what I did. Video games are a positive influence in my life. They've helped me appreciate and learn useful new technology. They've given me something to share with friends and family and develop strong relationships. And they've helped shape a fulfilling career where I've been able to work with a variety of creative disciplines. And I don't think it's an exaggeration that video games are at least partially responsible for all these wonderful gifts. But I got to enjoy all this, in part, because video games have always been designed to explicitly reach someone like me. A lot of things can get in the way of something as simple as enjoying a video game. Maybe it's a parent who doesn't foster an interest in games because they themselves aren't interested. Or maybe parents who actively discourage playing games because they're afraid of them. Or maybe it's the content in games or the marketing behind the games that can be dismissive, non-inclusive, or even outright offensive to anyone not squarely in the target demographic. Or maybe it's a toxic culture surrounding certain game communities, which can actively target and harass people deemed outside the norm, both through conscious and unconscious efforts. It was easy for a kid like me to pick up video games at a young age and continue enjoying them throughout my life because I was enabled by a culture that supported someone specifically like me to do so. Unfortunately, women, people of color, or the LGBTQ community do not get to enjoy such support and ease of access. Much of the problems that have always plagued this medium are just as prevalent today. So, knowing this, I share my story hoping that whoever is listening, especially if you're a parent, teacher, or someone who has influence over the youth, that you take stories like these seriously. You never know how anything a young person is passionate about, even a silly video game, is going to be a positive force in their life. Rather than dismiss it, try to understand it, and better yet, foster it, so it can blossom into something more. Something special. Someday, that young person may look back on it and thank you. With all that in mind, let's begin. Many of us have a mania. Our mania is something we love. Something people quickly learn about us. Something that our friends, family, coworkers, or even acquaintances use to remember us by. Think about the information we typically share about ourselves. Where we live. Where we went to school. What we do for a living. What we did over the weekend. But when you have a mania, it lurks beneath the surface, begging that the conversation steers towards it, waiting for the usual stuff to get out of the way. A mania can be a love of a sports team, an affinity for a media franchise, a devotion to a music group, or even something more broad like running marathons or a love of cats. Our mania is not something new. It's probably been with us longer than it hasn't, and it's not going away anytime soon. So, what is my mania? Well, it's a video game character named Sonic the Hedgehog. People I know get me Sonic gifts. They send me Sonic memes. They ask my opinion on Sonic trailers. And they tell me about other Sonic fans in their life. There's probably a Sonic-shaped sticky note stuck to a picture of me in the brains of everyone I know. Every time they see a piece of Sonic media or merchandise, they see a piece of me, too. I love learning about what someone is manic for, it always speaks to that person beyond the mania itself. One of my best friends has a mania for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, which is emblematic of his love and career in animation. Some of my extended family loves the Michigan Wolverines, because watching these football games is not only a tradition from their childhood, but it's also tied to memories of their late father. And my mom's love of the Rolling Stones is the tip of the iceberg for her love of classic pop music, movies, and culture. My mania for Sonic tells a lot about me, too. It broadly illustrates my love of video games, and the joy I receive from creating things, like movies, music, sound, and, of course, other games. Your mania is a symbol for what drives you, ignites your passion, and guides your thoughts and actions. Throughout my childhood, I never bothered to question my love of video games. I simply enjoyed the act of playing, sharing this fun with others, and used it as a catalyst to create something new. But as I entered college, and in the years following graduation, I began to question this fascination. Why did I love this thing so much? Why has it stuck with me while so many other people around me leave it behind? How had liking this thing impacted my life? Was it something to move on from, or something to embrace even more? Fast forward to today, and making video games is now a part of my job. And beyond that, it's one of my favorite things to share with people. But today, I'd like to go back to the beginning. Back to a blue hedgehog that I developed a mania for during childhood that stuck with me for life. Why, even as an adult, the spirit of this video game franchise still rings in my subconscious, spurring me on in moments both pivotal and mundane, always reminding me to play, dream, and create. All this began in 1993. I was 4 years old. I was shopping with my parents. We wandered by the store's electronics aisle. Several kids clamored around a TV. One of them was holding some small black slate of plastic as they gazed up at the glowing screen, so consumed as if in a trance. The screen displayed a vibrant world. Everything was pleasantly geometric. The world moved at a frantic yet comprehensible speed. One by one, as a few minutes passed, the parents shepherded their kids away, sometimes requiring a little force to get them to comply. Eventually, the TV was vacant. "Would you like to try?" said no one. As I found myself drawn towards the glowing, mystical shrine of a television like a mosquito to a lamp, I finally got a better glimpse at this strange new world. Everything danced with energy. The hills were bright green and the sky bright blue. Giant flowers spun in circles. In the distance, the ocean flowed and waterfalls crashed. Colorful robots shaped like cartoon bugs patrolled the area. The background music's beat was infectious, and all on-screen lifeforms danced with the catchy tune, as if the digital wonderland was sentient and knew how good it sounded. But all of this audiovisual splendor couldn't draw attention away from the blue character at the center of the screen. The character had big, expressive eyes. He stood upright with a circular head and body and with striking triangular spines running from his head down to his back. He had stylish red sneakers with a white stripe. He stood motionless, arms at his side, ready to move, his gaze set forward with cool, collected confidence. And then, as I stared, waiting for the action to resume, something happened. I realized I was no longer just an idle observer. And that's because the character stared back at me. The blue hedgehog angled his body towards the screen, breaking the fourth wall. He furrowed his brow and put his hands on his hips, visibly annoyed. He started tapping his foot. "What are you waiting for?" He grumbled silently. Let's move. I then remembered how the kids from earlier entered this amazing world. It was that black, crescent-shaped controller that had a plus-shaped button on the left and three circles on the right. All I needed was the character's nonverbal cue to know it was my responsibility to act. Within seconds, all became clear. Tapping these buttons caused immediate, satisfying action. The arrows made the blue hedgehog move. The circles made him jump and spin. Before long, I was running through the famous Green Hill Zone, speeding along ramps and loop-de-loops, collecting copious gold rings, bashing evil robots, and rocketing into the air. It was the digital expression of the pure, simple joy from unfettered athletic bliss, and the thrill was all mine for the taking. Eventually, I would make one too many mistakes, and the blue hedgehog would fall for the last time. The whimsical music turned into a mournful melody, and the words "Game Over" appeared on screen. The game reset and returned me to the title page. The blue character was now up close to the screen, and as he popped out of a circular winged banner and confidently waved his finger, I would finally learn his name, Sonic the Hedgehog. From then on, I had surrendered myself to the machine. This cool blue guy needed me to move. Now, I needed him to re-experience that feeling of speed and elation. The two of us would form a symbiotic relationship. I was 4 years old, but from that moment on, my loyalty to video games was solidified for life. This contraption that I encountered at the electronics store with my parents was called the Sega Genesis. Sega! A fitting name for the machine that fostered my love of video games. The Genesis was home to the first Sonic the Hedgehog games. In the 90s, Sonic was often one of two ambassadors who would enlist entire generations of kids like myself to the mystifying young medium of video games. You were either with Team Sega with Sonic, or you were with Team Nintendo with Mario, the king of game mascots that Sonic was explicitly created to commercially compete with. Ultimately, Nintendo's plumber proved to be the superior franchise in most any metric: game design, game sales, cultural cachet, etc. But during the 90s, picking between the two characters was like affiliating with a sports team, a political party, or religion. It said something about you. It was part of your identity. Back then, video games were feared by many a parent, teacher, or even other kids my age. Like any new technology, they were, as they still are today, misunderstood and feared, and thought to be the cause of various problems, like antisocial behavior, addiction, and apathy towards the real world. The reality is that only a tiny fraction of gamers are afflicted with these issues. But what baffles me is that our society often ignores the flip side. What are the positive effects of playing games? What benefits do we receive from something that consumes our engagement and imaginations so thoroughly? As Sonic helped me race into this new digital world, I have no doubt that the following great things happened in my life, which I shared at the top of this episode. I developed an affinity for technology, I had something to share with others and developed strong relationships, and I was able to harness my creativity. Trust me, I understand how attributing these positive things to a fictional blue hedgehog is hyperbolic. But again, when you have a mania for something, it's never just about the mania itself. The mania is a through line to something more. It can thread all the disparate pieces of a journey into a cohesive story. And I'd like to share my own very soon. But for the rest of this episode, I think it's important to take a second and examine just what this blue hedgehog is. While there are many, many other video game characters beyond Sonic that act as someone's ambassador to the medium, Sonic is on the short list of characters that have been part of video games since some of the earliest days. Sonic series has always ebbed and flowed as technology and culture changed throughout the decades. Understanding this might help you understand how the series influenced me and others. With that, let's dive into the sometimes wonderful, sometimes infuriating, and sometimes strange history of Sonic the Hedgehog. Sonic is, first and foremost, a platformer video game series. In platformers, players navigate a character across diverse terrain as you avoid obstacles, defeat enemies, jump across suspended platforms, and collect various items. As an example, the Super Mario series of games are platformers. Just imagine how he jumps from platform to platform, stomps on the little turtle shell enemies, collects gold coins, and jumps on a flagpole at the end of a level. All this is platforming 101, largely defined by the first Super Mario game in 1985. Since then, dozens of other characters have risen to differentiate themselves from Nintendo's mascot. This is where Sonic comes in. Sonic's defining trait is that he can run at supersonic speeds. One of the core game design mechanics of Sonic is that you're always trying to build up momentum so you can advance through a level at a high speed. The games are designed to keep you moving, reacting with split-second precision, and to enter a flow state of high-speed spectacle. And when you make a mistake, you repeat your run through the various gauntlets until you've achieved a state of stylish mastery. All this is set to gorgeous, colorful scenery and endlessly charming music. Running at super speed is a nifty power on its own, but it was born out of Sega's desire to make their Genesis game console look superior to Nintendo's Super Nintendo Entertainment System. And having a game that showcased unparalleled technical chops was the easiest way to achieve that goal. The blazing speed you could enjoy in a Sonic game was no small feat to pull off with the limited hardware of the time. Sega ran a blitz of advertisements, pitting their flashy new Genesis against the Super Nintendo, making it seem sluggish and ancient by comparison.
Hey guy, you're the first serious gamer I've seen all morning. Check this out, brand new 16-bit Super Nintendo with Super Mario World. Wow!
What's this one?
Oh, this is a Sonic the Hedgehog from Sega Genesis. Hey, look at these radical colors, huh?
Wow, Sonic's fast, too.
No, over here.
I like Genesis, and it costs a lot less.
Wait, kid, that game
there. I'll take Sonic and Genesis.
Sonic the Hedgehog, more action, more speed. Sega Genesis, it's a whole lot more for less.
But Sonic was more than a tech demo. He had a clearly defined personality that was somewhere between cool yet cute, confident and snarky, yet valiant and down to earth. That's why Sonic turns to face the camera and impatiently tap his foot when you put the controller down for too long. It's also why he smirks and wags his finger on the title screen of his games. This wasn't some generic, happy cartoon character or some blank shell of a character like Mario. This was a guy with some attitude. He was genuinely cool, the kind of hero you'd want to inhabit on a high-speed adventure.
Sonic, he can really move. Sonic, he's got an attitude. Sonic, he's the fastest thing alive.
The first Sonic game was released in North America on June 23rd, 1991. In the coming years, Sonic 1 was followed by several more titles in the main series of games, each showcasing better polish in the programming, more skillful art and level design, and catchier music. The new games would also deepen Sonic's mythos and give players additional main characters to control. First, there was Sonic's partner, Tails. A little fox named for his two fluffy tails that could spin like a helicopter and enable him to fly, and who was beloved for his cute design and little brother-like quality. And then there was Knuckles, the fire-red echidna with sharp fists that enabled him to climb walls, as well as dreadlocks that let him glide through the air. He had an edgier charm than Sonic and Tails, and skirted the line between friend and foe. The trio of heroes would be joined by many other characters in the coming decades, but Sonic and his crew have always had a common foe, the evil Dr. Robotnik, later referred to as Eggman. Robotnik is almost always responsible for turning the natural landscape into a mechanized dystopia and transforming innocent critters into his robot slaves. At the time, it was controversial to have an explicit message of environmentalism, but the game designers were passionate about this theme, so they decided to bake it into early Sonic the Hedgehog games without beating you over the head with it. For example, let's examine the levels you travel through in Sonic 2. First, there's Emerald Hill, which is full of grassy fields, bountiful green trees, and blue skies. But immediately following this zone is a zone called Chemical Plant. Factory that creates toxic sludge, set against an endless metal skyline in the distance. The rest of Sonic 2 features this kind of tonal whiplash in the theming of the zones, from the beautiful jungle backdrop of aquatic ruin to the pollution-spewing heavy machinery of Oil Ocean. From the scenic mountain hiking landscapes of Hilltop Zone to the near infinite industrial workings of Metropolis. It's the juxtaposition of natural beauty with the polluting, all-consuming nature of human technology. I always found it interesting that the game creators expressed such an anti-technology theme using some of the most advanced technology available at the time. But the fact that they did this was yet another sign that games were advancing as a form of cultural artifacts and as a way to express themes and ideas using interactivity and game design. The popularity of Sonic's first games led to an explosion of other kinds of Sonic media. First, there were spin-off games that broke away from the platformer genre. But beyond games, Sonic almost immediately expanded into other media. First, there was not one, but two different Sonic the Hedgehog single-issue comic series, one in North America published by Archie Comics, and one in Europe. Each series featured radically different storylines, characters, and art styles. But the American one is notable for holding the title of longest-running American comic book series never to be relaunched. Though it recently was relaunched when the rights to the series went from Archie to its current owner at IDW. Moving on, there was also not one but two Sonic animated television series. There was Adventures of Sonic the Hedgehog, which featured a Looney Tunes-esque sense of silly humor.
You did it, Sonic! Buddies forever, right, Sonic?
You got that right. Buddies forever.
And then there was the simply titled Sonic the Hedgehog, which had a darker tone and further explored the nature versus machine undertones of the series.
I don't say this often, Sonic, but you're right.
Hey, I'm always right.
Not always.
Yeah, always.
No way.
Yeah, way. Ask Nicole.
He's cool, Sal. Way best.
Sonic, what have you done to her?
Come on, Sal.
Yeah, get a grip, Sal.
Nicole?
Throughout the rest of the decade, there would be more Sonic comics, more Sonic TV shows, and, of course, many more Sonic games released on other Sega game consoles. But at the close of the decade, on September 9th, 1999, Sega unveiled the Sega Dreamcast console. Just as before with the Sega Genesis versus the Super Nintendo, Sega was hoping to close the gap created by its rival company and its Nintendo 64 game console, while also facing stiff competition from a new challenger, Sony, who entered the video game market with their highly successful PlayStation console. But this would mark the beginning of the end of Sonic's largely spotless track record. The debut Dreamcast game, Sonic Adventure, was the first true Sonic game to go from two-dimensional to full 3D. Now, when designing a new game in 2020, deciding to make a game 2D or 3D is often less a matter of technical limitations and more about deciding what fits your game design idea the best. But in the late 90s, embracing 3D was a necessity because it was finally possible for game hardware to render 3D graphics. And so, as a game development studio, failure to keep up with the times risked falling behind the competition, a race the creators of Sonic were determined not to lose. Sonic Adventure was also the first Sonic game to feature full voice acting for its cast of characters, The game broke with the all-ages and whimsical tone of previous games in favor of a slightly edgier art and music style. Sonic Adventure boasted impressive graphics and breakneck speed gameplay that was impressive for its time. Unfortunately, this game, and many that would follow it, would not age as well as the Sonic games on the Sega Genesis. Compared to the early days, there was a sloppiness to Sonic Adventure's controls and level design, and the transition from 2D to 3D proved awkward for a fast-paced game like Sonic. What's worse, the story and voice acting in this game was mediocre at best and cringeworthy at worst, a recurring element plaguing new Sonic games to this day.
Hey there, Tails! Did you find the tornado too?
Never mind that. Get up and follow me. Angel Island is falling again.
Hey, no way! Who blew it this time?
Oh, I don't know, but we'd better hurry!
In the coming years, there were more spin-off Sonic games and media. But in the public zeitgeist, the series was entering an obvious downward trend. A character that was once the king of cool was slowly becoming anything but. These problems were exacerbated by Sega's mounting financial troubles after various forms of mismanagement and tensions between the Japanese and North American Sega headquarters. As Sega floundered, Nintendo, Sony, and yet another new challenger, Microsoft, pulled far ahead, until Sega had no choice but to exit the video game console business for good. Now, there was an upside to this new development. Sega would continue to release software for its once competitors, meaning Sonic was no longer an exclusive property. He was now free to roam Nintendo's consoles, on PlayStations, Xboxes, PCs, whatever console he wanted, opening up brand new audiences to experience the character for the first time. But then came 2006, with the release of a new Sonic game simply titled Sonic the Hedgehog for the PlayStation 3 and Xbox 360. Now, while you can argue if recent Sonic games from this time were sloppy, it's hard to argue that Sonic 06 was borderline unfinished. The game was a mess of glitches, sloppy controls, and horrendous storylines and acting. Many consider this the lowest point in the series, and Sega knew it. That's why this era gave birth to what is now commonly referred to as the Sonic Cycle. Since Sonic 06, Sega would tease an upcoming Sonic game, promising it would bring back Sonic's old glory days with retro gameplay and polished game design. But, more often than not, this hyped-up game would release only to disappoint, or simply be mediocre. Games like Sonic Unleashed and Sonic Colors improved the 3D formula immensely. And in 2011, Sonic celebrated his 20th anniversary with Sonic Generations. Some, like myself, consider it the best 3D Sonic game thus far. But these are still diamonds in the rough, caused by a degree of tarnish the series still hasn't been able to fully break from. Thankfully, in 2017, a new chapter in Sonic's story helped rejuvenate the franchise a little. Since the 90s, entire generations of talented young programmers had cut their teeth by hacking early Sonic games to recreate or remix the experience, or build entire new games of their own. One particular group of fans even created a game engine that almost perfectly mirrored the programming and physics of the original Genesis games. One of these fans, named Christian Whitehead, demonstrated his expertise by recreating the first level of the game Sonic CD, pixel by pixel, and showcased it running on his iPod Touch. This was back in 2009, when mobile gaming was just starting to take off. Whitehead's demo even took advantage of the iPod Touch's widescreen display, meaning players could see more of the game world on screen than what was possible when the game first came out in the 90s. Sega was so impressed with his work that they decided to hire Whitehead to officially create a version of Sonic CD for iOS, and later for other game platforms. Whitehead was eventually joined by his peers from the Sonic fan programming community, and together they brought other beloved Sonic games from the Genesis onto modern hardware to more critical and commercial acclaim. But this was just the start of their work. In July of 2016, Sega released trailers for two upcoming Sonic games. The first was Sonic Forces, which looked to continue the recent line of 3D Sonic games. But the real buzz was around the second trailer, something that every fan of the series never thought we'd see, and also the inspiration for the episode title of this podcast. This game was Sonic Mania. It looked and sounded like it was straight out of the 90s, with a Genesis-inspired graphic aesthetic and soundtrack. Gone was the terrible voice acting and convoluted stories of recent games, replaced with a simple, charming plot that got out of the way so you could focus on play. And Sonic himself sported a classic-looking design, once again treading the line between cute and cool. Everything that any longtime fan of the series could have asked for was on display. When Sonic Mania released a year later, the game was met with the highest critical success of any Sonic game since the Genesis days. I love that this game exists. Not only is it one of my favorite Sonic games, but I love the story behind Sonic Mania's development even more. There's something beautiful about a multi-billion dollar media franchise slowly losing steam, only to be rejuvenated by people that grew up with that franchise, who were so enthralled with it that they were inspired to take up a craft, master it, and then return their gifts to the source of it all, decades later. But while Sonic Mania brought some much-needed credibility back to the series, it didn't fix all the problems. Just months after Sonic Mania was the release of Sonic Forces. This was the other game announced alongside Mania the year earlier, but it did not ride the same positive wave set by Mania. Forces was met with the typical mixed to low reception recent Sonic games were used to at this point. So now we're almost caught up with the present, with the most notable recent Sonic event, the Sonic the Hedgehog live-action Hollywood movie. In April of 2019, the first trailer for the movie was released, and it will forever go down in infamy. And that's due to one simple thing. Sonic just looked hideous.
Meow? Ah! Oh, come on.
Okay, pal, I want answers.
Basically, it looks like I'm gonna have to save your planet.
He featured a more humanoid body and face than his usual look, even sporting unsettling rows of human teeth. It's baffling. Such a bizarre design for the character was approved. Especially considering that Sonic's design is arguably the strongest quality about the character and why he's endured for so long. And yet, several months later, a new trailer surfaced with a complete redesign, and it was immediately beloved.
So, you're supposed to be Tom's best friend that he won't shut up about. Well, I don't see the appeal.
That is very gross! Let's
go! Sonic now more closely resembles his traditional charming look. It's safe to say people are much more optimistic about the film's release. As of the posting of this episode, the Sonic movie comes out this week. I mean, look, I seriously wouldn't have believed you if you would have told me back in the 90s that in the year 2020, there'd be a live-action Sonic movie and it'd be starring Jim Carrey as Dr. Robotnik. I mean, it's just so weird, and I'm definitely keeping my expectations in check, but I have to admit, I'm still pretty excited to see it. Phew! Well, we just traveled from 1991 to 2020. For almost 30 years, I've tracked each of the Blue Hedgehog's adventures across his various game platforms and media outlets. And beyond Sonic, I went on to discover the entirety of video games. But what comes after that? What comes from a life spent enjoying games like this? At the beginning of this episode, I cited three things: the love of technology, a career in creativity, and close relationships. When I think of these three things, I can think of a time where Sonic was a catalyst for them, propelling me through life as I discovered the things that I loved. That is the story I'd like to tell. Next time on The Curious Gamer. Curious Gamer was written, produced, and voiced by me, Devin Pulaski. Thank you so much for listening to me talk about freaking Sonic for half an hour. Jeez, don't you have anything better to do? So, you can listen to the rest of this show at thecuriousgamer.org. Please subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And it really, really helps the show out if you can leave a review or share it with a friend who you think would be interested. And also, I composed some of the music in this episode, but most of it is from incredible composers that have contributed to various Sonic games. So I'll list all the songs and composers I used in the show notes. All that being said, part two of this episode will be decidedly less about Sonic and much more about just games as a whole and how they can be a great influence in your life. So don't worry if you found part one to be Sonic overload. I definitely got it out of my system, I think. Thank you for listening. And no matter what you're doing, whether you're feeling up or down, remember this: you're never too old to enjoy your life and play.